karne pishnayamadevaha padram pashye markshabhiryajatraha stirairangai istushtuvagum sastanubhihi yashema devahitanyadayuhu swastina indra vrittashravaha swastina pusha vishwavedaha swasti nastarksho arishtanemihi swastino brahaspatir tathatu om shanti shanti shanti. We're on chapter 4 of Alata Shanti Prakarana, and we're on verse 4. No, 3. Verse 3.
It's 3.
No, it's 3. I meant that.
We have to do 3 and 2.
We did 2.
Did we finish?
Are you kidding?
I think we did.
Yeah, we did. We did. You don't think so? Yeah, we did. Yeah.
But thoroughly.
I mean, we could do it again.
2.36.
Verse 3.
I don't care.
No, we did it. We did it. I'm sure we did it. We did it enough, anyway. Bhutasya jatam icchanti. Bhutasya jatam icchanti. Varina kechar evahi. Varina kechar evahi. Abhutasya pare dhiraha. Abhutasya pare dhiraha. Vividanta parasparam. Vividanta parasparam. Bhutasya jatim icchanti vadinaha kechat evahi abhutasya apare dhiraha vividantaha parasparam. In the previous verse, because this verse continues on from the previous verse, at the first line of the verse, it said, what is Asparsha Yoga Vainama? What all of the Mahatmas, all of the Advaitins know very well as Asparsha Yoga. They know the teaching of the Vedanta, of the Upanishads, to be Asparsha Yoga. That's the Vainama, that which is called Asparsha Yoga. So what is called Asparsha Yoga? The Advaita Vedanta is called Asparsha Yoga. Because what the Advaita Vedanta, what the Upanishads have to teach is the non-dual nature of the Atma, the non-dual nature of reality. Once you say non-dual, one without a second, reality, what is satyam, is one without a second, there is no second thing. If there's no second thing, there's no sparsha. Sparsha, the word sparsha means touch or relationship. Like if I touch something, that's sparsha. So any type of relationship or subject-object relationship or two things meeting together, two things relating together or touching each other is sparsha. So here, the nature of reality is asparsha. There is no relationship because there's no second thing. And so that means, what that means is that all of this duality that you experience cannot have its own separate order of reality, separate from the nature of the Satchit conscious being, which is the Atma. Because then there would be two, right? This whole manifestation of duality has to be mitya, and the self has to be its adhishtana, kind of like clay pot. Clay pot, the pot totally depends for its being on the clay. The clay is satyam, pot is mitya, because there is no pot, really. But we experience it, so we have to account for it. But really, the only thing there is clay. So there is no sparsha between the pot and the clay. Because then the pot would have to be, the clay would have to be something else to touch the pot. Right? But the pot is a different order of reality. So that's our situation here. There's no second thing that is of the same order of reality as the Atma. We say all of this duality, all of these second things are only mitya. Means they're like the pot. They have no independent being at all. Zero. So in a sense, there's nothing here except for conscious being. So that's why it's asparsha yoga. There's no second thing to come into relationship with. And so the whole teaching of the Vedanta has to do with the recognition of that non-duality. Right? And there's nothing you're going to be able to do about it. Right? What are you going to do to reach the non-duality somehow, or to try to get your mind to go there or something like that? There's no going anywhere. There's no second thing. That's a discernment that has to take place. It's a knowledge that has to take place, not a touching or a, like say, in, for instance, in yoga, in the Patanjali yoga, or in Sankhya, which we're moving into now, that's why I'm bringing this up. Sankhya, the body, mind, sense organs of the Prakriti, has its own reality, totally separate from the Purusha, from the self. And so in order for there to be any type of moksha or liberation, this Prakriti, you have to do a lot of work, a lot of actions, a lot of karmas to bring this real material, Prakriti, into a state of total acquiescence, total silence, into a total state of resolution, and keep it there. Right? So you're actually dealing with something that is other than the Purusha conscious being. And so in order to gain moksha, you have a lot of work to do there, to bring this Prakriti into that state of absolute absorption so that the Purusha can just be free to be as it is. Otherwise, it's always having to experience the Prakriti, this world. But in Asparsha Yoga, in the Vedanta, there is no second thing. There's no second thing to... I mean, we can stop our thoughts, or we can do all kinds of things to stop them, but they don't do anything to yourself, and they don't cover yourself while they're there. They are basically no problem. Their presence or absence is not a problem, because it's a different order of reality. It's just like if I have an imagination... The imagination is not a problem to my being. It's an imagination. The whole universe, in a sense, it's not my personal imagination. It's this jiva, this universe, this body, mind, sense organs is part of this infinite imagination, Ishvara. Right? So this isn't my imagination, this all of this. But in terms of the stuff of it, in reference to the conscious being, it is the same relationship as my imagination is to that stuff. Same mitya relationship. This is a longer lasting, Swamiji will laugh sometimes and say, this is a longer lasting joke, that's all. Mm-hmm. You know? But that doesn't make it more real. It's more real in that it lasts longer in reference to my dream. But in reference to the Atma, to conscious being, to the Satyam, the Adhishtana, what is actually there, it's not in more or less real. Both are mitya. Okay? And so that's why the Asparsha Yoga, what is mitya, you know, which has no being of its own, can in no way impact or touch or do anything to, it's the nature of the self. So that Asparsha Yoga, then he says, that which the Mahatmas know. Those who know, those who are the teachers, the ones who are the Sampradayavits, who know the tradition of teaching, they know very well that this Advaita Vedanta, or the teaching of the Upanishads, is known as Asparsha Yoga, and that it is Sarvasattva Sukha. It is for all beings Sukha. It is the Ananda, the wholeness, the love, the fullness, that all beings enjoy. There is no other source of ananda. It is the source of being, the source of ananda, that allows any being, any sattva, any living being, whether it be spiders or mosquitoes or snakes or cows or humans or dogs or cats or mice, the ananda or the joy or the fullness that is the source of those vrittis, the source of those vrittis, the very source of love or ananda, is only that self. And it is that sukha, that is the source of that sukha, sarva-sattva. Sarva-sattva means for all beings. It is the sukha for all beings. And it is hitam. Because, see, the thing is that in samsara, all beings enjoy moments of happiness. And the Atma is the source for all of those moments of happiness. They're just getting a shantavritti, somehow from fulfilling the desire or whatnot, which is now reflecting the Atma without any type of agitation. And so those shantavrittis are just varieties of sukha that come and go, because all that they're able to experience, if you're samsari, all that you're able to know, really, until you know the self, is these differentiated experiences of happiness and sadness. All of them which are generated by my experiences in the world, my raga dvesha, my likes and dislikes. When my likes are fulfilled, I get a shanta vritti. When they're not, I get a dukkha vritti, or agitation. And so like that, my mind is on a roller coaster ride. And I like the shanta vrittis and I don't like the agitated vrittis. If the agitated vrittis don't reflect the sukha, the ananda, like the shanta vrittis do. And so I'm addicted to the shanta vrittis because they're closest to my nature. But for the Asparsha Yoga, you recognize the very source of the ananda which the shanta vrittis enjoy. The source of it. And that source is Asparsha Yoga. That source is never fluctuating. So for a person who recognizes that, the mind is agitated, the mind has a shanta vritti, it doesn't make any difference. Because you've differentiated that absolute shanti that illumines and is present in the very self of this, of these fluctuating mental states. The Atma is not a fluctuating mental state. And so its nature is sukha, is ananda itself. And because of that, that ananda is hitam. It is a blessing. It is beneficial. Where the fluctuating sukha vrittis, those mental modifications of little happiness here, little happiness there, the coming and going sukha vrittis, are not really hitam, because they always just leave you sad, because they go away. They're wonderful and great, and you're so happy to have that, and then you're so sad when they leave. So they're not really a blessing. Blessing is that ananda, the fullness, that all is well with me-ness, that is just there, and that's the end of it. That's a blessing. It doesn't turn sour on you. Something that is a temporary blessing is not that much of a blessing. It's only a blessing for the moment, and then it turns sour. It turns into dukkha. You know? So that the Buddha said, you know, every sukha is just a dukkha yoni. It means every little piece of pleasure is just a womb yoni. It's a womb for dukkha. It's a womb for suffering. Because it will give birth to suffering in its absence. That's his idea. But here, this Asparsha Yoga, there is no dukkha in the self. The self is advaita, it's non-dual. It's the very changeless being of this whole manifestation of maya, which is mithya and depends on that being for it, that being is its only being. So that being so, then he says, this Asparsha Yoga, which is being taught, means by the Upadeshita, this Asparsha Yoga, which is being taught, you know, by the Upanishads, is to be understood, it's taught by the Upanishads, that tam namami aham, I bow down to that, I salute that. Remember, these verse 1 and 2 are prayer verses. So here, Gaudapada is giving his pranams, is bowing down and giving his gratitude, first in the first verse to the acharya, to his teacher, and to this verse, to this second verse, to the teaching itself, to that sampradaya, to that tradition. So he says, tam namami aham, I bow down, I prostrate to that, to that teaching, called, well known as Asparsha Yoga. which is taught, and which is avivadaha, which has no, there's nothing to dispute. Avivada is a dispute. There's nothing there to dispute because there's no second thing, and there's no pramana that is available to us that can negate what it has to say. There's a pramana that can give us this knowledge, and there is no pramana, means of knowledge, that can negate it. So it's avivada. You can't dispute a knowledge given by a pramana unless another pramana can come and negate it. Because we're not talking about imagination here. We're talking about realities. And we're talking about things that are either known or they're not known. So if something is known and it withstands the inquiry of a pramana, then there's nothing. If it's the knowledge is given to you by a pramana and withstands inquiry, then there's no vivada, there's no dispute. And there's no dispute because there's aviruddha. Nothing is opposed to it. There would be a dispute, or it could be like this, or it could be like that, but there is no such dispute. There's no second thing that is going to enjoy that order of reality that would allow for it to be like this or like that. So that's what we're going to be looking at here. So that's his pranams. And the magical word there was the vivadaha and the avivadaha and aviruddha. There's no disputants, there's no one to dispute it because there's nothing it's in opposition to. So, because no duality, there's no second thing. So now he says here,
it's all right, Johnny.
Thanks.
I got new stuff.
Okay. Okay. You ready? So.
Yeah.
So these two verses were a praise of the Advaita, of non-duality. So now he's going to move into the Advaitins. Now he's going to move into what the Dvaitins say. There are many, many, many different types of Dvaitins, of dualists. Right? So all of the other, if you're not a Dvaita, if you're not one without a second, you're going to be some form of Dvaita, of a dualist. There's two or more realities. Okay, so here he goes like this. He's going to talk about two types of Dvaitins, and different schools can belong to either type. It's really short lived. It's got a really short life now. It's almost dead. It's going downhill. Yeah.
Is it the batteries or the whole thing?
No, this time the tape went in all messed up.
It's on life support.
It's on life support. It's on life support. It's okay.
I have a story about that.
Yeah, it'll be okay. He has a new thing now. These things have a way, when their end comes, you know,
yes,
there's nothing you can do. Mm-hmm. It's dead or they're dying. That's it. So, bhutasya jatam icchanti vadinaha kecha evahi. So anyway, so this is the thing. He's looking at now two types of Dvaitins. The first one is going to be the Sankhyas. The second one are the Nyayaikas, the Vaisheshikas, and also the Bauddha. Doesn't really matter. That it's just that these different types of darshanas are coming from two different places. One is called the Asatkaryavadins, and the other is called Satkarya. Never mind, it's all too much detail. Let me just tell you what it says. So,
I
Bhutasya jatam ichanti vadinah kechadevah evahi. A vadin is a disputant. Of all of the different types of philosophical, what they call darshanas, of all of the different darshanas, each darshan, each disputant, they're all arguing with each other. They're all actually arguing within duality. That's the problem. If you're taking a position within duality, there's always going to be another position that you can take, right? Because you're within duality. Duality, there's not one position, there's an infinite number of positions. So as long as you're within duality, you're going to take one position or another, and the positions are going to be arguing with each other. So this particular position has to do with this. Whether something is which is born, you know, something which is born, what was its prior condition? If something is born, what was there before it was born? If what was there before it was born, right, actually existed, and it came out of that, then it wasn't really born. But if what was there didn't exist from which it came, then it couldn't be born. So let me just give it, let me tell you what this is to get back in the groove here. Vadinaha kecha evahi. Okay? Some vadis means some disputants, some darshanas, ichanti. What they want to say is that something which is born, jatam, there is the birth of something which is Buddha, of something which exists. So birth, there can only be the birth of something which exists. Okay. But then others, abhutasya apare dhiraha, other bright ones, but other bright ones, what they say is, if they want to say, is that something that is born has to be born of something which is not there, which doesn't exist. Right? So one says, a thing that is born has to be of something which does exist. But the other one says, no, if something is born, it can't have a prior existence. Okay? So this is a big problem. And so then he says, vividantaha parasparam. So arguing with each other, these two positions, arguing with each other, the one says, is something which exists is born. And the other says, no, something that does not exist is born. Okay? So now here's the problem. The Sankhya, for instance, will say, well, they're called Satkaryavada, means the effect actually exists, comes from something which exists. If that's so, if something that is born comes from something that is already there, then there can't really be a birth, because the thing that is born is already there. So how can that thing, can you say that that thing is born? But then if you say, what if you say, something that is born can't be there? So that means it's coming from something that is not there. But if it's coming from something that is not there, it has no something to be born from. And so, I use the example in that case, like for instance, a horn of a rabbit. Say if you have a horn of a rabbit, there is no such thing as a horn of a rabbit. There is no horn of a rabbit, right? And so you can say if a horn of a rabbit wasn't there before, because it had nothing, it's a satkarya. It had nothing to come from. But the horn of the rabbit is not there either, right? There is nothing there. Nothing can come from nothing. That's the idea. Nothing can be born from nothing. And if something is already, the thing that's to be born is already there, it can't be born because it's already been born. Right? So either way you say it, the Advaitin will say, I'm fine with either way. The fact is that nothing is born. Because that's the Advaita position. Nothing can be born. Nothing is ever born. Nothing can come from non-existence because it's not there from something to be born. And if a thing is already there, then again it can't be born because it's already there. And so if we go back to the good old clay pot, the Advaitin is going to go into bring in this Maya. It has to bring in Maya because from its standpoint, from the standpoint of Advaita, the self, the Atma, what is actually there, the being that is actually there, has never been born and will never be born, never goes through any modification at all. And so this universe, which is subject to continual birth and death, that birth and death actually can't be real. It has to have a different order of reality for it to happen at all. Because being itself can't be born, it can't come from non-being, and being there already, it can't be born. So just take existence itself. Existent, because this is where the argument's going to end up. Being or existence as a noun can't come, can't be born from non-existence, because non-existence is not there for anything to be born from it. But if existence or being is already there, say it's birthless, it's already there, then nothing can be born from it. Right? It can't be born from it because it's already born. Are you going to say existence is born from existence? It can't be because the existence is there. So the example they use for that is to show the satya-mitya relationship. Is say, for instance, the clay pot. If you have a ball of clay, right, and say it's a big jagged ball of wet clay, okay? Now that jagged form of the clay, you know, is dependent upon the clay, right? But still, really, it's a jagged form of what a ball of clay. But the thing that's actually there is the clay. Now you make that ball of clay into a nice plate. Okay? Make it into a nice plate. And now you say, the plate has been born. But actually, in terms of order of reality, there is no thing plate. There's still only the clay. Right? And so, in that relationship, we're not going to say that the clay, the pot, in reality has been born. In reality, there is no pot or plate. There's only clay. And the clay hasn't been born. The clay remains as clay. So that's the Advaita position. Now, say you take the Dvaita position, which is going, they're arguing with each other. They're saying either, okay, we have a pot here, and that pot itself has to have something from which it is born, or it can't come into being. It can't be, because it can't be born from non-existence, right? But what is the prior condition of the pot? What is the thing from which the pot is born? You either have to go, this is going to be the problem, this is what Gaudapada is going to be getting into now. You can't jump orders of reality, right? Because from the standpoint of the clay, there has been no birth at all. Clay has remained as clay. But the Sankhya wants the pot to have been born from an existent thing. But the existent thing is already there. So there's no birth, right? And so the Bauda and the Nyayikas and some other schools recognize it, but in a dualistic way, they say that doesn't make any sense. You can't say that something which is already there is born. Now say it's something that's already there. You can't now say that that is born. So they negate that. They say that can't possibly be true. And therefore, what is there now, right? It has to have not been there before. Okay, so now say, so that's going to be born from something that is not there. So now go back to the clay pot. We're going to say, okay, the pot was not there before. Right? The pot was not there before. Now, how can the pot come? If the pot was not there before, or if there was no being for the pot from which, no prior condition from which the pot could come, how could it come? Because it's all like saying that its prior condition is non-existent. So you have to get rid of the clay. Get rid of the clay, and now have the pot come. The pot's going to come from nothing. Right? If the pot comes from nothing, that's not possible. Because only non-existence can come from non-existence. There's in fact no coming at all. Right? So then you have to go to something like, what could come from non-existence? Well, only something else that doesn't exist. Right? Which is not there. So neither is possible. So what the Advaitin will say is we agree with this, you know. What this amounts to is that nothing is born. One says, you know, birth comes from something is born, something that is born comes from something that's already there. Well, that's not going to be a birth. And the other says, well, something is born has to come from something that is not already there. That means it's coming from non-existence, and so that can't be a birth either. And we agree with that. There's no such thing as birth. You're negating each other, you're fighting, we agree with the outcome of your dispute. And so here, just to go back to this particular verse, he's saying some disputants, what they want to say, what they're trying to say, is that something which is born, there is birth for something which already is. Is there. There's birth for something which already is there. Whereas other also wise ones, they're disputing, arguing about this, saying, no, the birth has to be from something that is not there. And either way, it won't work. So what he says in this next verse, these are like a little set. Let's read this next verse. Bhutam na jayate kinchit. Bhutam na jayate kinchit. Abhutam naiva jayate. Abhutam naiva jayate. Vivadanto dvayad yevam. Vivadanto dvayad yevam. Ajatam kyapayantite. Ajatam kyapayantite. Bhutam na jayate kinchit, abhutam na eva jayate, vivadantaha dvayaha hi evam ajatim kyapayanti te. Depending on the version of the Upanishad that you have, that second line is going to read either vivadantaha advayaha or vivadantaha dvayaha. We're just going to take it as dvayaha. If he says advayaha, it's tongue-in-cheek. He's making fun of them. If you just say dvayaha, dualist, then it's... Swamiji takes it as dvayaha. So because of sandhi, it can actually be broken either way. It's one of those conditions that can be taken either way. It doesn't hurt the meaning, except one, he's being sarcastic, and the other, he isn't. So here, what he says, what Gaudapada says is, bhutam na jayate kinchit. He says, nothing which is already there, kinchit na kinchit, means nothing. Nothing bhutam, which has been, which is already there, jayate, can be born. Nothing which is already there is going to be born, because it's already there. Bhutam na jayate kinchit, abhutam naiva jayate. And that which has no being, abhutam, it has no being, of course it can't be born because it doesn't exist. Abhutam, never. Abhutam, what is not there, naiva, naeva, naiva, can never be born. So what is already there, but it's already here. That can't be born, right? What is that? He says literally, nakinchit. What is there? Bhutam can never be born. Is never born, because it's already there. And what is abhutam? What is not there? It is never born because it doesn't exist. Neither is possible. Vividanta these dvayaha hyevam, he says, these dualists who are vividanta, arguing like this, disputing each other in this way, in this manner, he says, they ajatim kyapyanti te. They are clearly establishing, putting forth ajatim, that there is no such, there is no birth. Right? In their dispute, because in their dispute, both of them are ending up negating each other, and we agree with that. We agree with where they end up, that there can't be any birth. Either way, both are wrong. Because if one says that there can be, the birth has to come from something that is not there, that's not possible. Because that will just end up in non-existence producing non-existence. Non-existence is not there to produce anything. That's not possible. It's also not possible for something that is already there to be born, because it's already there. That's also not possible. And so, you know, each one is negating the possibility of the other in their argument. And in that negation, we accept the conclusion that there's no possibility of anything being born. Okay. So, ajatim kyapyanti te. They establish this well in this manner. Okay. So now let's go to the next one. Kyapyamanam ajatim taihi. Kyapyamanam ajatim taihi anubodham. Anubodhamahevayam, vivadamo natai sardham, vivadamo natai sardham, avivadam nibodhate, avivadam nibodhate. Kyapyamanam ajatim taihi, anumodhamahevayam, vivadamaha na taihi sartham avivadam nibodhata. He says, we anumodamahevayam, we happily accept that moda means rejoice, anumoda means to accept something, we happily accept anumodamahevayam, the ajati, the state of there not being any birth, kyapyamanam, which is clearly being established by them. We happily accept that. That the ajati, jati means birth, ajati means that there is no birth. We happily accept the no birth, which is being made clear, so clearly established taihi by them. Vivadamaha na taihi saradham. It says, vivadamaha na saradham taihi. We don't have any argument with that, with them. We don't have any dispute. The na vivadamaha, that's the first person plural, we. Na vivadamaha. We don't have any argument, saradam, with either of their positions, taihi saradam. We have no argument with either of their positions. They've both established ajati, that there's no birth. So we have no argument with them. Avivadam nibodhata. Now he's talking to his disciples, and he says, may you understand, to his students, may you understand avivadam. There's no dispute here. Understand, we have no dispute. There's no problem. Because they're negating each other, and they're just leaving everything, in their negation of each other, they're establishing what we're saying, that there is no such thing, there is no jati, there is no such thing as birth. Because just think about this, what it means. In terms of maya, in terms of duality, this duality that we experience, which we say is mitya, where is there birth for something that is mitya? Mitya has no being. To say that it's being born, it has no independent being of its at all. Say you have an imagination. Okay? Do you have an imagination? Has the imagination been born? What has it been born? There's no being there to be born. The being of the imagination is not born. The being that the imagination enjoys is not born. The consciousness that the imagination enjoys is not born. So the actual self, the actual content of the imagination is free from birth. And the being that the imagination enjoys there is birthless. And can you say that the imagination, like the horn of a rabbit, does that have being to be born? Say, no, it doesn't have any being to be born. Like, say, if I ask you right now, imagine a pine tree. Okay, there it is. Has it been born? Has the pine tree that you've imagined been born? Well, that's interesting. What was its prior condition? Yeah. Has it ever been born? It's totally irrelevant. Birth and death don't apply to it. Birth and death apply to the substance, what is actually there. Has what is actually there been born? That's what we have to look at. And that's what we will be looking at. What is actually there? What is its prior condition? Just think about that just for a minute. Like, say, something is. If it has a prior condition of not being there, something that is, its prior condition is not or was not. It is now, but prior to that, it was not. Okay? Now, if that's so, how can it be now? Because you're saying, what was there before was nothing, was not. No existence. We're not talking about clay and pot where there's a satya-mitya relationship. Saying, here's something is, and it was born. But it was born from nothing. And so how can something come from nothing? That's not possible because there's nothing there from which it to come. And now what if you say, no, it was there. It was there. So then how could it be born? If you say it was there, how could it be born? It couldn't be born because it was already there. So no, it was not there. There was nothing there. It was born from nothing. But if there is nothing there, it can't be born. Either way, it can't be there. It was there, and so it wasn't born. Or it was not there, and it can't be born. See what I mean? That, it sounds silly in a way. And the reason is because this satya-mitya relationship is, we live that relationship out every moment. So for instance, to just give you an example, if I use the example of the clay becoming a pot, becoming a plate, becoming a tumbler, you don't have any problem with that. Of course, the pot wasn't there before. I had to make the pot. It wasn't there before. I don't think about the clay. I take the clay for granted. See what I mean? So I just think, yeah, the pot was there. The pot wasn't there before. And then I make it into a plate. The plate wasn't there before, you know. And then I make that into a tumbler. The tumbler wasn't there before. So that's how I think. I don't think at all about what was actually there the whole time that didn't go through any change at all. And in fact, the pot, the plate, and the tumbler have no being apart from that one thing that never changed. We don't think like that. We're just looking at these objects that are coming and going. And now, based upon that, I can get into this dispute, you know, forgetting all about the clay. That's the thing, we're forgetting all about the clay. So, even in Sankhya, it's like that, because in Sankhya, they have as their primary cause what they call prakriti, which is going through modifications all of the time. But if it's going through modifications all of the time, what was the prior condition of those modifications and of that duality? So even when they get into their primary material that they call Prakriti, they're running into the same problem. Because in Prakriti, these things are continually changing. So where is the substance that allows those changes to take place without having non-existence as their prior condition? Just remove the clay and you see the problem. Anyway, we'll be getting into this. I know it's a little, might be a little bit over your heads because I haven't spent a lot of time on Sankhya and you don't know all of these terms. We'll get there over time. So, anyway, what, say from the Advaita position, using the clay pot example, Advaita recognizes the clay as being the only thing that is there. It doesn't matter to the clay whether it's in the form of a pot or a plate or anything else. It's still only clay. And the clay has not been born. And within the confines of this example, there is no birth at all for the clay. These names and forms go on changing and changing and changing, but it doesn't do anything at all to the clay. But if you're in a Dvaita position, a dualist position, you forget about the clay. You're only dealing with these names and forms that you're experiencing and wondering, you know, were these forms born? They were born from something or they were born from nothing? See what I mean? Advaita doesn't have this problem at all. They were not born. Because what is actually there is not born. If something is seemingly born, that thing is what we call mitya. It's seemingly born. Otherwise, it has the problem of coming from only from itself or coming from nothing. And so that's why they say for us, there's no problem. We're not disputing any of this. There's no problem at all. They're only substantiating what we have to say by knocking each other out. In their dispute, they're knocking each other out in their dispute, and in the end just agreeing with us is that it's impossible for anything to have been born. So that's what it is. Let's stop there.
Wow.
Yeah. We'll make it through those few verses.
Good.
Swasti prajabhyat paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmane vyashubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parajanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yamsho barahitah Brahmanas santu nirbhayaha. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha. Sarve santu niramayaha. Sarve bhadrani pashyantu. Ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet. Asato ma sadgamaya. Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya. Mrityorma amritam gamaya. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishate. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
So You might have answered this question later, but a question came up for me earlier on, I think on verse 3. What did the Samkhya say that
is the part
born from?
Prakriti.
So do you just call it generally Prakriti, and
yep.
It modifies from what in some form?
Yeah, I can just briefly kind of tell you real quick.
Okay.
Prakriti is very similar to Maya in that it's made of sattva, rajas, and tamas, and it goes through very similar process of going through projecting the five elements and then going through panchikarana. Very, very similar. But the prakriti for them is not considered, Maya is mithya. For them, that prakriti is real. And the prakriti is made of sattva, rajas, and tamas, and the elements of the prakriti, of the sattva, rajas, and tamas, when the world is in unmanifest condition, because they still see the world as cyclical, the sattva, rajas, and tamas are going in continual movement within themselves, sattva within sattva, rajas within rajas, tamas within tamas. So there are a lot of parts that are continually moving and changing. But they're changing within themselves, and so that's why there's no manifestation of the creation. Then at some point, the purusha, and there's many purushas, each purusha is like an infinite conscious being. That's another problem, but that's, anyway, there's many infinite conscious beings. But nevertheless, the purusha gets close to the prakriti, and like a magnet to iron filings, excites the rajas aspect of the prakriti that causes these particles to start reacting with each other, that causes that process of manifestation. So the thing is, this is the problem. There is nothing in the prakriti that is ever stable. It's always continually changing. And they look at that as an ultimate, the prakriti is an ultimate real entity that has its own existence, even though it's made of parts and continually changing, it is its own existent entity. And the purushas are all existent, so they're dvaitins. Okay. So now the problem is when we look at this, try to establish this prakriti as something that actually exists. So they say everything comes from the prakriti, but then where does the prakriti come from? What is its essential being? Because everything in the prakriti also is nama-rupa and continually changing. So you have to take it all the way back, which they're not doing really in this example. They think this is another problem with teaching like Gaudapada and the Brahma Sutras and these texts. They think that we already know completely Sankhya and the Vaisheshikas and the Nyayayikas. We know all of their arguments, we know what they're talking about. And so when we have to know what the prakriti is and what are the problems with the prakriti, even itself, what is its prior condition, where did it come from, what is its essential nature, because itself is made up like of a bunch of pots and plates, because continually changing. And so where is its being? So it goes back like into an infinite regress. But they don't take it, Sankhya doesn't take it there. Sankhya just takes this manifestation back to prakriti, because there must be something there from which all of this has come. But then when we analyze the prakriti itself, it's continually changing. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas other schools, like the Bauddha, if they take this creation back into some kind of a cause, that cause is non-existent. It's not there. So they're more like mithya, but with no satyam. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh, so, and one thing you were saying in the midst of that was, if we were, say, students of Gaudapada, we would have already known all this.
Yes, all these darshanas.
Thoroughly,
inside out. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. And this is why
that's why he doesn't need to go into detail explaining them.
And Shankar doesn't either, because he'll just say Sankhya or Vaisheshika, because you already know all of this. So then it's up to. That's why when we were at the course, Swamiji had a pundit come in and teach us all of these different darshanas, not in tremendous depth, but in enough depth to be pretty familiar with them. Because they're just referred to, because you're supposed to know all of those things. And even logic and grammar, all of these things you're supposed to know. And Shankar just refers to them. Which is okay, if somebody like Swamiji's teaching it, then he'll explain it all. And I'll explain it to as best as I can.
But you that's need some understanding to really
that's
know
right.
what you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah.
Thank you. It sounds like a pretty convoluted theory. Samkhya.
There's a lot of problems. A lot of logical problems. Yeah. A lot of holes in it. And at the same time, it's similar to Vedanta because they have a Purusha, which is pure consciousness, and they have Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, and, but it's not Maya, it's Prakriti. Mm. The Purusha is just like the Atma, except there's many of them. You know? And they're different from the Prakriti. So.
Well, if there are many of them, then there's no non-dual.
It's not non-dual at all. It's definitely dual.
Non-dual.
There's only one thing that's going to be non-dual. That's non-dual. Once you're non-dual, then there is no second thing. There's not too much else you can say. Once you say one without a second, then this universe has to be what we call mitya, or it's going to be dual right away. If it's not mitya, it's dual, and you can't say it's not here, because here we are experiencing it. So what order of reality are you going to give to it? If you're Advaita. Advaita means one without a second. Means there are not two things here. Advaita, if there's two things here, if you're giving two things, different separate orders of reality and on an equal level, then that's Dvaita. And Dvaita is very hard to prove. It's very easy to dismiss, actually, and very, very hard to prove.
Do they actually have people attain moksha? I'm just kind of wondering, because you'd think that, you know, if that's happening in one school only, why wouldn't everyone flock to the one school?
Well, the thing is, everyone is going to have a different type of definition of moksha. Mm. And so within that system, they will tell you what they think moksha is. Whether that moksha is attainable or not, I'm not going to get into that, because I actually do have a lot to say about that, but I have to set it up first. There's too much to... A few sentences would just be misleading as to what the problems are with it. But one thing that's not just easy to say is if you define moksha as something that can be achieved through a practice, any type of practice, that moksha then is going to be subject to change because it's something which is achieved through a practice. So what if you stop the practice? In other words, you're producing it. If something, if it's produced through karma, then it's going to be a product. And the product is not going to be timeless.
Then it can't be moksha.
Well, it can't be moksha, no.
Not by our definition.
Not by that definition.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, exactly.
It's going to have the same problem also, that it's going to be... born.
Yeah, exactly. It has these problems that I see are serious problems, but they're only serious problems if your mind, see, if you're within that particular conditioning of time and space, then this is the best you can do within time and space, or you're producing something. So you can have a practices which produce certain states of experience, and you have to keep up those practices. See what I mean? But those practices can become natural, And they can be based on your knowledge or practices based on your knowledge that become natural to you. And so because of your knowledge, and so you're keeping up those practices, you can have shanti in your mind. But Advaita Vedanta is not talking about shanti in your mind. You can gain, and a lot of practices that we do give you antakarana shuddhi so that your mind has relative shanti. But that's just a secondary gain. That's not moksha. Moksha is the recognition of that which is free from time.
The way...
That's not produced.
The way that I clarified it completely for me, because I was doing the yoga thing, and it was always trying to gain this samadhi experience.
Right.
But you always come out of that experience. But, and they say in the end, well, when you die, you get
Mahasamadhi,
but you have to die. And then, it's no proof, or whatever. But the one thing I remember Swamiji said, the problem is one of ignorance and self-ignorance. And the only thing as opposed to self-ignorance is knowledge. And that made complete sense to me.
Then there's no problem, because that means that you always are liberated. The problem is ignorance. Right. In fact, all of the darshanas say in the East, for the most part, they accept that ignorance is the problem. It's just that they're needing to use, because they're stuck within duality, practice to get you out of that misidentification, because the objects that you're identifying with are real. That's in the Sankhya. And the Bauddha has its own problems. Bauddha is, in a lot of ways, closer to Vedanta, I think, than Sankhya. Anyway, I'm leaving huge holes when I'm talking. It's not the right thing to do. I don't have enough time or words to go through it all. But to unfold these things. Actually, we could do that, not now, but we should sometime go through all the darshanas. Just, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tedious. Hard to remember, because it's not all logical. You have to remember all of these things that they're saying. But it is kind of interesting. Hi, Susan. Hi, Virginia. I'm Maitreya. Hi, John. Hi, Dachin.
It seems like, in a way, it's kind of, this passage is torturing the word born in a way, or it's not, it hasn't really defined what born means.
What?
Born. B-O-R-N. So.
Getting into it, though. It is going to, and it did also in the Advaita Prakarana. They've gone through a lot of that previously. But we are going to go into what born means.
More. So we're using it currently without a definition, or we're relying on the one from the third chapter, third section.
Yeah. They're even pulling some verses from the third section.
Okay. Because, I mean, earlier you said, like, the pot isn't really born, but why are we talking about it then?
Because, like, I was bringing an Advaita Vedanta.
No, I know.
Oh.
I know, you said the clay we made into a pot and the plate in a tumbler.
Yeah.
But they're not really there. It's only clay that's really there.
That's Advaita.
I'm aware of it.
Yeah, I know, but the others, why I brought that in is to show why that's all fine from the standpoint of Advaita, because what is actually there is not born. But if that clay is not taken into consideration for the Dvaitins, then where does the pot come from? What is its prior condition? Does it come from nothing? See, it's a non-issue for Advaita, and it's not an issue, because what is there is the very substance, satya mitya. But if there's Dvaita, then from where does that thing come?
Well, we've already established that what's there is a name and a form, but you can't just say the name and form aren't there. That's ridiculous.
You can't. You were not saying they're not there, though.
Well, you said the pot's not there.
Without the clay.
Okay.
Pot's not there without the clay. If you take the clay out, then there is no pot. But the clay's not born.
The pot is simply okay, so you have a raw jagged lump of clay,
yeah.
And then you make it into a pot, and the clay is not born.
Right. But do you say that the pot is born?
It's there, produced.
But
born, well, I don't know what born means. I mean,
from what does it come? From what does the pot come?
It comes from the mind of the Creator.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. But if we're talking about the material cause.
The material cause is obviously the clay.
Right, but the clay wasn't born.
Right.
The clay was already there. So we can't say we wouldn't, and that's what song.
So you're saying that when things change form, but they're not born; they're just transforming.
They're transforming, but what is the thing? Is there anything that's coming into being?
I mean, if a pot's in front of me, I'm going to say it came into being.
Okay, but in terms of substance, the substance was already there, and this is kind of what the Satkarya says: what was actually there. Has it come into being? Because it's still there. It was there before, and now it's there.
Yeah.
So that's what the Sankhya will say. But like the Nyayayikas and others will say, no, that's not a birth, because it was already there. So that's what they're arguing about. So they'll say that the pot itself had to be born from nothing. But then the Sankhya will say, yeah, but nothing can come from nothing. Right, so that's not possible.
Okay. This might be semantics, but following up on David's question, so you have clay that's in the form of a pot, and then it's reshaped into a plate.
Yeah.
Could you say that plate was born, the name and form plate was born from the pot?
No. How could you say that? Because the pot itself was only the clay.
Well, and so is the plate.
Yeah.
But the name and form are new.
That's true, the name and form are new, but they gain the title of being mitya. Right? Because the name and form are dependent upon something else. And so now if we say, well, that's something else that there's dependent on, you know, was that born? We say, no, that wasn't born. That was already there. So something that was already there, you can't say is born. So the clay was already there. So the clay isn't being born. Then you say, well, did the pot come from non-existence then? We say, no, the pot can't come from non-existence because non-existence isn't there for it to come from that. That's the argument.
So the bottom line in our from our point of view, then is that everything's already there. I mean, that's the whole point.
The
only one thing is already there.
The only one thing is already there.
Okay.
And the pot and the plate and the order have a different order of reality that we call mitya, that doesn't have any independent being of its own for these questions to be meaningful.
So that's the main contribution, or the monster contribution of Advaita Vedanta to the world of philosophy, is the satyamitya.
Advaita, satyamitya. Because without mitya, and see the thing is, with mitya everything starts to make sense and everything falls into place, and we have in the world what they call drishtantas, and logical syllogism. You need to have examples that you can tie your syllogism to, and we do have examples for it. We have the dream, we have imagination, we have projection. You know? So it exists. This Maya exists in the world, in our experience. If that's why I like rope snake, for instance. And clay pot for the material cause relationship of satyamitya, dream, projection, imagination, rope snake, for that mityatva of the imagination.
Actually, rope snake works better for me than clay pot. talking about born, because clearly the snake was never born. It's just imagined.
But you have to be able to see it, I think, in both ways.
I don't get it so much with the pot, because the pot could have been a plate before.
Yeah, but that doesn't matter, because the clay, as long as it was the one piece of clay, in terms of the example. Because whether it's a clay pot or plate or tumbler, nothing's happening to the clay. Clay remains as clay.
That part I get. The clay is clay and it's unborn.
I think you keep talking about the material cause part of it. Yeah. There's the other part of it.
The efficient cause?
Yeah.
The efficient cause is going to be different. Efficient cause means that then the upadi, like the Ishwara upadi or the upadi of your mind, right, is using consciousness.
Right.
But consciousness is still that vivarta. It doesn't go through any change. But now we're getting into the, like the pot maker or the creator.
That's hanging something up here. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, what you're saying that is that has to come into play too. Yeah. And it will.
Why is it so important to spend so many verses on born, not born, came to existence, didn't come to existence, beginninglessness, effect, cause? Why is this just continuously grounded on? Really?
Satyamitya, yeah.
To pound that in.
Pound.
Okay. I get it, because I'm confused about born now more than I was. And maybe it needs to be defined and will be, I guess.
Well, you know, it's actually pretty simple. Uh-huh. When we think about change, anything that changes, anything that changes is the death of the prior moment and the birth of the next moment. So birth and death and change go together. So any birth is a change. Okay. So what was the prior condition of that change? Because it's always the thing that you've changed into something is the birth of that new thing and the death of the prior condition. So when we think of birth and death, we're thinking, oh, I'm born and I die. But if you look at every moment of change, you know, it's the death of the prior condition, the birth of the new condition.
Which is always going to be impossible, right? Mm-hmm. There's nothing is ever born. From that point of view, like, that makes sense.
Well, and also, from that point of view, in terms of change, change takes place in time, and so it's infinitely divisible. And so then it goes back into an infinite regress. You know, and so birth and death go back into an infinite regress also, which is interesting. That's a little bit off, but it's still true what I'm saying, but it's a little bit off of this argument. Mm-hmm. Let's stop. You wanted this text, you got it.
Thank you. I think it's great. Can I ask a totally different thing?
Sure.
This is completely unrelated. So who are the direct path people and what is their approach? Direct path, have you heard of that? Oh, okay.
No.
They're people who call themselves Advaita Vedantins, but it's sort of a new thing.
It might be
Nisargadatta and you know, the people from him and his teacher.
I know what it is, I can tell you.
What is it?
After the class. Okay. Or I can tell you now.
No, let's not do it now. I'm tired. I'm interested, but not right now.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I would guess what it is, though.
What would you guess?
That there's no distance between knowledge and ignorance, and so there's no distance between moksha and yourself. It's direct and immediate. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to get. But anyway, I'll hear about it later. That's just what I would say, knowing nothing about it. I've never heard it before. Okay, everybody.
David, do I need to check this?
Oh, don't say no yet. Did you already?
No.
Okay, I would show her to log in.
Okay. Hi, Virginia. To say that a plate was born from a pot, wouldn't you also run into the problem exactly at what moment the plate was born from? That's true. That's just what I was saying, too. That's right. Yeah, it would be good to go with Vidarshanas.
I don't know.
Oh, sure, you saw Jagadish there. That's right. I can't wait to talk to you.
Yeah.
Find out about all your experiences
sure
in India.
The cursor's blinking there.
Hi, Nella. Good night.
So be Sunday evening. So be
806. Acharya Van Purusha Veda. Oh, that would be interesting.
4, 5, 2. And then just join?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, put your name.